This program is about unsolved mysteries. Whenever possible, the actual family members and police officials have participated in recreating the events. What you are about to see is not a news broadcast.
...1971, the Philippines. Roger Rojas, an amateur treasure hunter, found an intricate system of tunnels dug by the Japanese during World War II. Rojas claims that deep inside, he discovered an amazing hidden treasure, a solid gold Buddha and countless boxes of gold bars. But Rojas's joy was short-lived. He soon found himself imprisoned and tortured at the orders of Philippine President Ferdinand Marcos. And as for the treasure, possibly worth billions, its whereabouts remain an unsolved mystery. Caitlin Arquette was a popular, vivacious honor student who dreamed of becoming a doctor. But in 1989, Caitlin was brutally and senselessly gunned down, leaving her family haunted by unanswered questions. Who killed Caitlin and why? 20 years ago, a large caring family in California took in a 4-year-old girl whose father needed help to care for her. Now that family asks for your help to find the young child that they loved and accepted as their own. Join me for these fascinating stories. Perhaps someone somewhere has that one vital clue that can help solve a mystery. Perhaps that someone is watching. Perhaps it's you. From 1965 to 1986, Ferdinand Marcos ruled the Philippines, first as an elected leader, then as a virtual dictator. By the time Marcos was deposed, his personal wealth was estimated at $10 billion, much of it allegedly looted from his own people. Few dared challenge Marcos publicly, but on May 5, 1971, newspapers in the Philippines carried a startling front-page story. A Filipino locksmith and part-time treasure hunter named Roger Rojas was accusing Marcos's henchmen of ransacking his house and stealing a rare solid gold Buddha, which Rojas had found while excavating near his home. Just days earlier, Roger's brother had taken this photograph of Roger and the Buddha. Roger was 27 years old at the time and in the prime of life. Roger Rojas is now 49. But his health is ruined, wrecked by torture and years of living on the run. Roger's nemesis, Ferdinand Marcos, died in Hawaii in 1989, a fabulously wealthy man. Today, his estate is a target of a number of lawsuits, including one filed by the humble but unbowed locksmith, Roger Rojas, who dared to cross one of the most powerful men in Asia. In 1970, Roger Rojas and his family lived 200 miles north of Manila on the Philippine island of Luzon. Roger worked in nearby Baguio City. On weekends, he was part of a large group of Filipinos whose avocation was treasure hunting. One of Roger's fellow treasure hunters was Albert Fuchigami, whose mother was Filipino, but whose father had been an officer in the Japanese Army during World War II. Fuchigami had painstakingly recreated from memory a map which his father had showed him as a youngster. The map pinpointed the location of a secret tunnel system where a fortune in gold bars had allegedly been left behind when the Japanese were driven from the Philippines.
We were friends for a long time before he told me that he knew of a hidden treasure. He revealed to me what he knew about the tunnels. I had very high hopes because Fuchigami was the son of a Japanese soldier.
Roger Rojas and Albert Fuchigami hired a crew to excavate. In the first few minutes of digging, they found a layer of Japanese shrapnel. A few weeks later, the crew broke through into the tunnels, which the Japanese had apparently dynamited shut. The tunnel system was elaborate, complete with railroad tracks. For the next few weeks, Rojas and Fuchigami explored the labyrinth. They found that one explosion had blocked all access to the main underground passageway. Undaunted, they dug a narrow tunnel around the rocks.
I was the first one who went in because I was concerned for my companions. If there was a booby trap, then they would die. Because I was the leader, I was the one who went in first. To my surprise, I found several Japanese skeletons. There must have been more than 10.
Roger had stumbled upon a forgotten tomb. Japanese soldiers had apparently been trapped underground when their own retreating army set off explosions to hide the tunnels. The explorers were stunned. In a hidden cavity, a Buddha, which appeared to be made of gold, stood solemn guard. Roger knew that the Buddha was not native to the Philippines. He assumed that it had been plundered from one of the Southeast Asian countries conquered by the Japanese during World War II. While their crew attempted to move the 2,000-pound Buddha, Rojas and Fuchigami ventured farther inside the tunnel. Just as a map had predicted, there were boxes upon boxes of solid gold bars. Rojas and Fuchigami hit on a plan. They would dynamite the tunnel closed to safeguard their find, then sell the Buddha to buy trucks and equipment to transport the gold. Roger Rojas took the Buddha home. A potential buyer confirmed that the Buddha was solid gold. He offered Roger 1 million pesos, 160,000 US dollars, as a down payment.
Salamat, Mr. Orihara.
Gracias, Mr. Rojas.
After the buyer left, Roger and his brother decided to take a closer look at the Buddha. Roger had noticed that the buyer paid special attention to the Buddha's neck.
My brother and I had a suspicion that there was a joint, an opening inside the Buddha. So what we did was, we got a piece of wood and we hit the Buddha several times with this piece of wood.
Roger says there were several handfuls of diamonds inside the Buddha. Some were rough cut, some fine. Roger hid the diamonds in a closet.
Diamante?
That night, Roger's brother took these pictures of Roger with the Buddha. Roger thought the photographs would protect him, but news of his discovery had already spread fast and far, all the way to the President's Palace in Manila. Although the Philippines was still nominally a democracy, Ferdinand Marcos, along with his wife Imelda, ruled with virtual autonomy. When Roger found the Buddha in 1971, Marcos was in his prime, and his primary tactic was brute force. Two months after Roger brought the Buddha home, soldiers swarmed his house. The red ribbons on their rifles indicated that they were members of President Marcos's elite palace guard, in effect, his personal army. Out of nowhere, the buyer appeared.
Gusta, Mr. Rojas.
Roger had been double-crossed. With the buyer was another civilian who seemed to be in charge. He ordered the soldiers to ransack the house.
They took everything, even the piggy banks of my children, even the picture album. Whatever my wife inherited, all her jewelry, all the diamonds in the closet, they took all of it. What would have happened if we had fought back? They would just have killed us.
The next day, Roger and his brothers reported the incident to the local police. Then he went to visit Judge Pio Marcos, a family friend for whom Roger had once worked as a chef.
I told him, Judge, why did you let them confiscate my treasure? We're friends. He said, Roger, there is nothing that I can do. I said, why? He said, because the prince asked for it. I said, who's the prince? And he said, the prince, President Marcos.
Pero Judge,
inuwala ta mga ganyan.
Mali ang ginawa mo na tinawagan mo ang pulis sapagkat ngayon, malalaman ng mga tao na ang pangulo ay kasabwat sa kasong ito. Malaking pagkakamali. Dali mo ang pamilya mo at umalis na kayo rito sa Baguio. Delikado ka. Pinirma na ang death warrant mo at hahabulin ka na ng CIS. Wala na akong magagawa para sa iyo. Bahala ka na, Roger.
In June of 1971, on the Philippine island of Luzon, members of President Ferdinand Marcos's elite palace guard seized a golden Buddha from the home of Roger Rojas. The next day, a judge warned Roger that there was a price on his head. Roger and his family fled to an isolated jungle village. While Roger remained secluded, Filipino reporters had already gotten hold of the story. Marcos did allow the press to view the Buddha, but his political opponents felt that Marcos had substituted a fake. One opposition cabinet member, hoping to embarrass the president, convinced Roger to come to Manila to identify the Buddha.
Ako ang representante ng kaling hukuman na ito. Kailangan gawin mo ang gusto kong gawin. Buksan mo to. Gawin mo.
Ginoong Rojas, ang Buddha ito ba'y kapareho sa natuklasan mo?
Hindi. Hindi yan ang aking Buddha. Ibang kulay. Yung Buddha ko, natatanggal ang ulo. Ito, hindi natatanggal.
Pinipilit mo ba rin ba ng Pangulo ang siyang nagnakaw ng natuklasan mong kayamanan?
Yun ang palagay ko. Kasi yung mga soldiers pumasok sa bahay ko, kinuha ang Buddha ko. At kinuha pa din ang alahas ng asawa ko.
Kapanik ka ba ng oposisyon?
Hindi naman ako mahilig sa politika eh.
Salamat, Roger. Maraming salamat po sa inyo lahat. Maraming salamat po. Roger, magaling ginawa mo. Magaling paglingkod sa bayan ginawa mo.
Hindi talagang Buddha ko yun.
Alam ko.
Marcos and his minions were outraged. Once again, Roger fled Manila. But 2 weeks later, he says he was tracked down by the palace guard.
Three men approached me and pointed their guns at me. They knew me. They told me, Roger, come with us in the car. We will bring you to Manila. I could not escape. I knew they were soldiers. They had guns. They were so happy. They were drinking whiskey, saying, so, finally we got him, the famous, the famed Roger Rojas. They called the palace and they were speaking English. I knew that it was Marcos that they were talking to because they addressed him as Mr. President. Marcos must have asked them, are you sure it is Roger Rojas that you captured?
Yes, sir.
And they said, yes, we're sure.
Thank you, Mr. President. The boss is really happy to hear we have you in our custody.
Oh,
The soldiers demanded that Rogers sign a confession authenticating the Buddha and saying that he had been paid off by the opposition party. Rogers says that when he refused, the palace thugs brought in a crude electroshock machine fashioned from automobile batteries.
Magtiwala ka sa akin. Gusto kong malaman kung saan mo nakita ang ginto.
Then they showed me a picture, and they said, Roger, do you know who this is in the picture? And I said, yes, that's my wife and my kids. They said, Roger, if you love your family, cooperate with us. Show us where you found the golden Buddha.
Rogers says he endured hours of torture, which permanently damaged the nerves around his left eye.
I made a promise to Mr. Fujigami. His name is Albert. I told him, Albert, even if they try to kill me, I will not tell them where the tunnel is. So they had to persecute me. And while I was conscious, I really tried not to tell them where the location of the tunnel was. That was my promise to Mr. Fujigami.
Roger says he was held captive at a hotel in Manila and tortured almost daily for several weeks. Finally, he agreed to sign a document stating that he had been paid off by the opposition party.
Magaling. Ano naman ang gagawin mo, Rojas?
Sama ko sa courthouse.
Roger's captors allowed the worst of his wounds to heal. Then they took him to a courtroom in Baguio City and ordered him to point at Marcos's Buddha. He was photographed several times, giving this tacit sign of approval.
Magaling. Ibalik mo si Mr. Rojas sa kotse.
Oo. Tayo naman, Mr. Rojas.
I-publish mo yan bukas. Unang pahina. Tama.
Pumunta muna kami sa...
I went to my wife first and my kids. My wife was crying. She was surprised. She said, what is happening to you? You know they might kill you. And I said, just pray.
So alam ko, maiwan ako doon sa pamilya ko.
I stayed with my family for about 10 minutes, and then the soldiers took me again.
Roger was summarily re-imprisoned in the same hotel where he had been tortured.
I knew they were going to kill me. But you know, I'm a locksmith. I know how to open locks. So I went to the restroom. There was a small window with a small lock.
Roger Rojas went into hiding and never again saw the Golden Buddha. The strain of living underground tore his family apart and eventually led to a divorce. Roger, who has remarried, continues to make his home at an undisclosed location in the Philippines. When Ferdinand Marcos died in 1989, his personal assets exceeded the entire Philippine National Treasury. Roger Rojas is convinced that the source of that wealth was the countless boxes of gold bars. As for the Buddha, no one knows exactly where it is. In 1975, at least two witnesses claim to have seen it at one of Marcos's summer palaces. Rumor has it that the Buddha is still somewhere in the Philippines, hidden by a member of the Marcos family.
Of course, it's very painful. I worked very hard for it. I spent so much time, about 7 months, that we really labored hard. And then in 1 hour, they take it all away. It's very, very painful.
Through a corporation Roger Rojas formed with a friend in the United States, A suit has been filed against the Marcos estate. The case is currently in the docket in Honolulu. Roger has established a foundation to assure that a large portion of any settlement money he may receive will go to provide education, medical aid, food, and job training in the Philippines. Next, a young woman is gunned down in her car. Was she the victim of a random shooting or the target of a hired assassin? On June 14, 1989, 18-year-old Caitlin Arquette graduated from Highland High School in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Kate was an outgoing, popular honor student who'd been accepted at the University of New Mexico. She planned one day to attend medical school. Shortly before graduation, Kate moved into an apartment with her boyfriend, using money she had received from an insurance settlement.
We're almost finished, honey. Let me take you out to dinner.
As far as we could tell, Kate and her boyfriend did get along very well.
I can call a couple friends over.
Well, I was just kind of hoping it could be just the two of us.
He was 8 years older than she, but we didn't know it because they lied to us. She knew we wouldn't let her date someone that much older. We thought he was only 4 years older. He seemed like a nice guy. He was around the house a lot. We liked him.
6 weeks later, on the afternoon of Sunday, July 16th, Kate admitted to her mother that she and her boyfriend had been having serious problems almost from the moment they moved in together.
Mother, all you have to do is tell him you don't know where I am and you don't know when I'll be back.
It's a lie. It's not fair. He's gonna be worried about you.
Mother, please. You don't understand.
She told us she'd had a big fight with her boyfriend. She was breaking up with him. And she was going to a girlfriend's house for dinner.
I'll see you later.
And she would either spend the night there or come back and spend it at our house. She was not going to go back to the apartment.
Kate visited her girlfriend from 9:30 to 10:45 p.m. She then headed east along Lomas Road toward her mother's house.
Before midnight, the phone rang. It was a phone call from the emergency room of the hospital. They said Kate is there, that she's been injured. And I said, what's happened? And they said they wouldn't tell me. They said, we can't tell you on the phone. So my husband and I drove to the hospital, and Kate had been shot twice in the head. She was in a coma.
5 hours later, the police arrived at Kate's apartment. Her boyfriend was home alone, seemingly unaware that his girlfriend had been shot and was near death.
We're with the Albuquerque Police Department. Just, like, come in and talk to you a minute.
Sure. What's this about?
I just want to ask you a couple of questions to look around. You mind?
No. Just tell me what's going on.
Just like to know where you were tonight.
I was out with the...
Caitlin's boyfriend told me that he had been out with a couple of friends. They had eaten, they'd played pool, and they had a couple of drinks.
Or so. Just tell me what's going on.
While I was there, myself and the other detectives, we discovered a note on top of the kitchen table, and the note read something to the effect, "Hun, I'll be home at a certain time," that sort of thing. It was my belief that he indicated to me that the note came from Caitlin. It must have come from Caitlin because he was not home, and when he got home, he found the note there.
Yes, she did.
I think you should sit down.
Caitlin's boyfriend stated that he and Caitlin did argue, and they did have their disagreements, but he was not aware of her at any time wanting him to leave the apartment or move out or anything that severe.
When the police left the apartment, Kate's boyfriend went straight to the hospital and joined her family in a bedside vigil. Less than 24 hours later, Caitlin Arquette was dead. Her boyfriend had remained by her side until the very end.
6 months after Caitlin Arquette's murder, the Albuquerque Police Department announced that she had been the victim of a, quote, random act of violence. Caitlin's mother, Lois Duncan, refuses to accept their ruling. Following her daughter's death, she began to uncover the first dark hints that Kate had somehow gotten mixed up with a major criminal organization. To this day, the police continue to pursue the random victim theory, but Lois Duncan is convinced that her daughter was executed by a hired assassin.
We're all set. No questions asked.
2.5 months before she was killed, Caitlin and her boyfriend took a trip to Southern California. It was at that time that Kate apparently became involved in a lucrative car insurance scam.
One of our daughters told me that March, a couple of months before, the boyfriend had staged an accident, a fake accident, in a car that Kate had rented for him with our credit card.
The scheme was allegedly orchestrated by an organization comprised of powerful members of Southern California's Vietnamese community. Everyone in the accident complained of soft tissue injuries to the neck and lower back, which were later treated by a doctor who was part of the organization. Ultimately, a paralegal working out of an Orange County, California law office handled the insurance claim. Kate and her boyfriend were given $1,500 as their share of the settlement, which they used to rent the apartment.
Everything went well.
It was evidently a major multi-million-dollar insurance scam, and Kate had found out about it. At the time, we didn't know how we could fit this in with her shooting, but all of a sudden, there was another element there, something that suggested a possible motive, because if Kate was breaking up with her boyfriend at that time, then maybe she was a danger to the people who had arranged this.
A few weeks after Kate's death, Lois was putting her daughter's affairs in order when she made a disturbing discovery. 3 phone calls had been made from Kate's apartment at virtually the same moment she died.
In fact, they were made just minutes after she was pronounced dead, when her boyfriend was with us at the hospital and the apartment should have been unoccupied. The number turned out to belong to a Vietnamese paralegal in Orange County, a paralegal who lived in Santa Ana but worked in a law office in Garden Grove. And it was the same paralegal who set up the car wrecks.
Lois wanted me to look into Caitlin's relationship with a boyfriend. Lois felt that not everything was right there. That there had been some real problems and that the police had failed to take a look at it.
What was going on?
Mike Gallagher first met with Kate's former landlord.
Mostly with her boyfriend's friends. Mm-hmm. They didn't treat her.
I had the impression from neighbors that Caitlin was more afraid of her boyfriend's friends rather than her boyfriend. She would get disturbed when they only spoke Vietnamese around her. The friends, her boyfriend's friends, tended to make fun of her and cause friction between her and her boyfriend. And she did not like his friends. I think the feeling, from what I could gather, was mutual.
How can you let them treat me so lousy?
They do not treat you that way.
They do. They make fun of me.
Evidently, things were much more stormy than we had ever guessed. And it wasn't just a little lover's spat. There was something very major happening in Kate's life after she moved in with her boyfriend. And she told us she was very sorry that she had ever let him move in with her. It had been a big mistake. She wanted him to move out so her girlfriend could move in instead.
Mike Gallagher was able to obtain a copy of the note which Kate allegedly left for her boyfriend on the day of the shooting. He compared it with another sample of her handwriting.
It was obvious just by comparing the handwritings of the note with Caitlin's writing that she did not write that note. And that led me to believe that within hours of her shooting, her boyfriend was already lying to police.
The landlord also told Gallagher that on the night Caitlin died, three of her boyfriend's associates were in her apartment drinking. Kate's mother is convinced that one of them made the phone calls to Santa Ana.
I don't think that the Vietnamese connection is related to this case. Thus far, I have not received any information and to indicate positively that the Vietnamese is involved in this homicide.
Was Caitlin Arquette executed because she had learned too much about the auto insurance scam? While Kate's family and Mike Gallagher were pursuing their investigation, the police were going in a completely different direction.
I'm trying to cooperate with you guys. I'm telling you the truth. I don't remember what happened.
6 months after the murder, an informant led the Albuquerque police to a young man named Robert Garcia.
This incident, this Arquette killing.
Garcia was interrogated for 2 hours. Finally, he admitted that on July 16th, 1989, he was out with three friends when one of them shot a woman in her car on a dare. Based on Garcia's statement, police arrested Dennis Martinez, Juvenal Escobedo, and Miguel Garcia, who is not related to Robert. According to Robert Garcia, it was Miguel who did the actual shooting. On the same day that Robert Garcia was interrogated, the police discovered that Escobedo had recently sold his car, a brown Chevrolet Camaro. Suddenly, an eyewitness report that they had initially disregarded took on a new significance. On the night of the murder, a truck driver said he saw a brown Camaro chasing a young woman in a car similar to Caitlin's in the area where she'd be gunned down an hour later. The police believed that the men in the Camaro had been out joyriding, and Kate became their random victim. It was later learned that Robert Garcia had in fact been in jail on the night Caitlin was shot. Ultimately, all charges against the three suspects were dropped for lack of sufficient evidence.
Well, talk to you guys later.
We certainly appreciate you coming in and talking to us again and all your cooperation. Got a few questions.
Finally, under pressure from Kate's family, the police questioned her boyfriend once again.
First of all,
this time, he admitted that he and a friend from Albuquerque had taken part in the auto insurance scam.
Our relationship was going great. We had our arguments, but...
Nevertheless, charges had never been pressed against him or any of his friends in connection with that scam. In addition, Caitlin's boyfriend is not considered a suspect in her murder.
...or any time in the past been involved in a Vietnamese gang.
I think it's important for the police to remember, and anybody who looks at this case to remember, that Caitlin's boyfriend's friends were involved with large-scale organized criminal activity in Los Angeles and multi-million dollar insurance frauds. I don't think the police ever took that seriously.
Caitlin Arquette was killed in July of 1989. In this most bizarre case, there seemed to be two viable theories, leaving Kate's family to wonder who in fact was responsible and why did they target Kate.
Our family doesn't have any real idea who pulled the trigger on Kate. The one thing we feel very strong about is that she was not shot randomly as just people out on a spree having fun shooting a pretty girl in a red car. We believe Kate was killed because she was going to talk, was going to expose illegal activities involving her boyfriend and his companions. It might have been that she was shot by the Vietnamese. It might have been that they hired someone else to shoot her. The one thing we're absolutely sure of in our own minds is that this was not a random shooting. Kate was assassinated.
Next, a family's poignant search for the young girl they raised as their own. On August 4th, 1990, 24-year-old Shannon Tim Payne was married in San Francisco, California, surrounded by all eight of her brothers and sisters. But one very important person was not there to share the joy of that special day. 20 years earlier, when Shannon was still just a toddler, a four-year-old girl named Terry Lynn Smith had come to live temporarily with the Tim Paynes in Orange, California. She stayed for 6 years, and in every way became a member of the family. It seems that some families, no matter how large, have more than enough love to go around. The Tim Paynes have not seen Terry Smith for more than a decade, and they feel that without her, their family will never be complete. Perhaps someone watching tonight can help bring Terry Lynn Smith back to the ones who still love her as their own. John and Jerry Tim Paine met in 1945. He was an intern specializing in obstetrics. She was a nurse. Between 1953 and 1965, John and Jerry had 9 children, 6 boys and 3 girls. The Tim Paine household was boisterous and bustling. The entire family loved animals and enjoyed an active outdoor life. In the summer of 1967, at the ranch where they boarded their 2 horses, the Tim Paynes came to know the manager of the ranch, Herb Smith.
I tell you what, why don't you go get this big guy some carrots? Terry, help Shannon with the carrots, will you please?
Was that your little girl, Herb? Yeah.
Herb was divorced. His daughter Terry and son Mark lived with him in a small trailer. But Herb felt that the ranch was no place for a young girl. He believed that Terry needed a real family.
I think the first time I saw her, I thought she was rather forlorn. Here was this little girl on this large ranch, and while she loved horses, there were no children for her to play with. There were mostly cowboys. I was drawn to her because she was so sweet, and she was so happy to come and talk to me. And I just decided to talk to my husband about it and see if it would be feasible for us to take another one. We always had an extra bed in the house for somebody.
Herb Smith took Jerry Tim Paine up on her generous offer. In return, Herb insisted that the Tim Paynes allow him to take care of their horses free of charge. They promised Herb that they would bring Terry to visit him whenever he wanted. In August of 1967, Terry Smith moved into the already overflowing Tim Paine home.
Hi, Herb.
Is she okay about staying?
Well, I think in the beginning, she was just a little girl that was staying with us. But as the time grew longer and longer, she stayed with us as a sister. And she was included in everything in the family, so she therefore became part of the family.
All the Tim Paine children grew to love Terry. But for Shannon, the youngest, Terry's arrival was a dream come true.
There was a succession of boys in my family, and I was the youngest little girl, and I couldn't really hang out with them because they didn't want me to. I think Terry and I were especially close because we were so close in age, and things seemed to happen to us at the same time. We both learned to swim around the same time, and she basically taught me how to ride, and we got the chicken pox at the same time.
I think Terry loved being part of the family. She'd call them her brothers, she'd call them her sisters, and I think she enjoyed it very much.
Years passed. The temporary arrangement had in effect become permanent. None of the Tim Paynes could remember life without Terry. She shared in all the family's joys and in all their sorrows. On May 2nd, 1972, the family was scarred by tragedy. 46-year-old John Tim Paine succumbed to cancer. Jerry Tim Paine was forced to go back to work as a nurse. Because she had teenage children who could take care of the younger ones at night, Jerry worked the graveyard shift. That way, she could be at home every afternoon when the children returned from school and every morning to see them off.
Of course it was tough, but there was nobody else to do it, and I decided I had to do it. That was going to be my future, and I had 9 children or 10 children to raise.
Hi, everybody.
So I did.
How was work?
Oh, it was fine. I'm just a little tired. Is everybody up?
Shannon and Terry are still sleeping. I think Brendan is too.
It's okay.
Money became a very big concern. And my mom was not around as much anymore because she was now the primary supporter in our family. So that also changed because she used to be there all the time.
Come on, girls. It's time to get up. Come on.
Even though the Tim Payne family managed to cope, having one more mouth to feed was now a problem.
Come on, girls.
With a heavy heart, Jerry Tim Payne realized that she would have to send Terry back to her father.
And when I told the kids, they said no. They didn't want me to send her back. And I said, but it has to be, and I don't want to do it, but it's one of those things that happens. And she has her father, and she's going to go with him.
In the summer of 1974, Herb Smith came to take his daughter home. Terry had lived with the Tim Paynes for more than 6 years.
She was very sad. She didn't want to leave. We were her family. She'd grown attached to us.
Bye. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
On the other hand, I think Terry was really excited to go home and live with her father again. She loved her father a great deal. And when she went to visit him on the weekends, it was always a real special thing. And she came home with many stories of what they did and where they went. And
if it were summertime, she would come and spend a week with us. And she loved coming back. She loved having the swimming pool there. She loved having the friends that she had made and the family around her. And unfortunately, these started to get less and less because they had moved to a different part of the state, and it was difficult to get her here.
In 1980, when Terry was 16, she surprised the Tim Paynes with one final visit.
Well, it was great seeing you, Terry. You should come by more often.
The reunion was bittersweet. Terry was no longer living with her father. And though she had brought her boyfriend with her to meet the Tim Paynes, she seemed uneasy and uncertain about her future.
Bye. Bye, Shannon.
I got a sense of feeling that she was not as happy as she could be. We talked more, and then her friend said that it was time to go, and they left. And that was the last time I saw her.
I didn't realize that would be the last time I saw Terry, because if I would have known that, I would have stopped her. There would be no way I would have let her go. It was very confusing, and we were trying to get her to stay, and we never asked where she was going because we were trying so hard to get her to stay, and we lost touch. I don't think that we ever forgot Terry. Everyone has a special place in their hearts for Terry. They have their own special relationship, and they would not forget that. And they want to make sure that she's safe and secure. They miss her a lot. Everybody talks about her all the time. You know, when we reminisce, and everything always includes Terry, you know?
Join me next time. Perhaps you may be able to help solve a mystery.